This is Karen Brewster, and today is May 6, 2024, and I'm here in Eagle River, Alaska, outside of Anchorage, with Nolan Heath, and we're talking today about the Iditarod National Historic Trail. And so before we get into the trail stuff itself, I just wanted to kind of get some background on you so people know a little bit about you. I mean, you worked for BLM, but get us to, you know, where and when you were born, coming to Alaska, that kind of stuff.
Oh my gosh.
It could be brief.
So I was born in Wyoming, and in a little town called Worland, Wyoming, and was raised there. Have seven brothers and sisters.
Wow.
You know, farming community, grew up, you know, all about farming and that. Then I went in, when I graduated from high school, went into the military, served, was a veteran of the Vietnam War, spent my time over in Germany. When I left the military, I came home and served a mission for my church in California. Spent 2 years there in California. Mm-hmm. And then I came back and started attending the University of Brigham Young University in Utah, and pursuing a degree in mechanical engineering.
Mm-hmm.
I was asked if I would drive a girl up to Alaska at the end of my first semester there. And I had a job waiting for me in Michigan with a friend of mine from the military. And he said, when I called him and said, this crazy girl wants me to drive her up to Alaska, he said, you should go. I was up there, TDY, once. It's a great place. Go have some fun. You've never done anything wild and crazy in your life. Come on back when you're done. So I told her I would. So I loaded her up in my car and drove her up to Alaska and dropped her off at her sister's house. And went down to the gas station, filled up my car with gas, and pulled out my last $10. Put it in the, paid for the gas. I had no place to stay, no job, no money. That was my start in Alaska.
And what year was that?
That was in 1979. May of 1979.
Okay.
And so I went to church the next day, and a captain in the Air Force, Skip Goodrow, said, hey, I've got a extra bedroom, come crash with me until you get a job, you help me. And that's my start in Alaska.
Yeah.
A couple days later, I had a job working for a local welding company. And because that's what I did in the military, was welding.
Okay.
And so I worked for them for a few summers going to school. I met my wife up here that summer. We got married that next fall down at BYU down there, in Salt Lake there. And I pursued my education, wound up with a master's degree in mechanical engineering.
From BYU, or you were doing
it? From BYU.
So you went back to Utah for a while to finish the degree?
I went back every year to school at BYU.
Oh, so you just worked here in the summers?
Yeah, I worked up here in the summertime.
Okay.
A couple of summers I stayed down there where I worked through the summer and went to summer school. One summer I was down in Phoenix, Arizona with Garrett Turbin working on my master's thesis. And then when I graduated, I got a job at Elmendorf as a mechanical engineer on base there, and did several projects there for about 3 years. Several of those projects were related to natural gas. putting in natural gas into their barracks and buildings and stuff. And I converted their power plant to natural gas. And then a friend of mine worked for NSTAR and invited me to apply for a job there. And so I applied and they hired me. I worked for 2 years with NSTAR.
Which is the local utility, or is it just gas?
Local gas utility.
Okay.
And then another friend of mine invited me to apply for a job with the pipeline office with BLM. They were looking for a gas engineer to head up the gas pipeline project. So I applied for that and was hired there. And then that project, they decided not to pursue that. And so they switched me over to the oil side, and I worked as an engineer with the Trans-Alaska pipeline system. And
because the pipeline was already built, you were helping manage it.
Yeah, the right of way.
Okay.
And working with the right of way project. Then my boss moved on, and I applied for his job and became the pipeline officer, right of way officer.
So that was like head of the office there?
Yeah. It was a joint office with the state, so there's like five federal agencies and about eight state agencies that all had employees that worked together there in that office. And so we coordinated. There was a state lead, and I was a federal lead, and we would coordinate the oversight and compliance with the terms and conditions of the right-of-way. Then, after about 4 years there, I had mentioned to my boss at the state office, BLM state office, that I was interested in learning more about BLM. And the next day, he invited me up to the state director's office, and we switched places. And I become deputy state director for minerals, and he became the pipeline officer. And shortly thereafter, the U.S. had a buyout program for people. If they'd retire, they'd give them $25,000. And so the deputy for resources retired, and the state director combined minerals and resource divisions. And so I became the SD of all of the mineral and resource programs in
the, what you just used an acronym that I don't know. DSD, is that what you just
Deputy said? State Director,
okay.
I'm sorry.
That's okay. As long as we say it once, then you can keep doing it. I'm sure it's just part of your vocabulary.
Yeah, it is. And yeah.
So now at least it's a DSD, so we'll know when you say it what that is.
Yeah.
So the pipeline, when you were the pipeline officer and worked for the pipeline office, that was that a BLM position?
Yes.
Okay, what year was did that start?
That was from 1990 to 94.
Okay.
And then in 94, I transitioned over to deputy state director of minerals.
Right.
And a year later, they combined it with resources. And a year or so later, I can't remember exactly, they closed down the Bureau of Mines. And in Alaska, they transferred those employees to BLM. And so the state director had me incorporate them into the Minerals and Resource Program.
Mm-hmm, right.
So I had those folks, which included an office down in Juneau. And so that was basically the start of my career in the resources side of BLM.
Right, and so it was around 1996 or so you became the DSD.
About 94.
Oh, well. Oh, I see.
Yeah, and then I was deputy state director of minerals. And then 95 or so as combined with the resources on land side.
Okay.
And
okay. And you were in that position until you retired from BLM?
No, I was in that position for about 10 years.
Okay.
And then they asked me to go back to the pipeline office to help them with Alyeska was rebuilding their pump stations, and they asked me to go back and help with that project because of my engineering background.
Mm-hmm.
So I transitioned back to the pipeline office and was there for about 15 years.
Okay.
And then the last year and a half or so, I went back to the resources division before I retired.
And so when did you retire?
In 2019. Okay. January of 2019. And so with my military time and my time on base and all that, I had about 34 years in with the federal government.
Right. And, I didn't realize that there was that joint pipeline office. I thought there was a joint pipeline office when the pipeline was being built.
There was. It wasn't structured quite the same as it was when I was there.
Mm-hmm.
'Cause after it was built, that joint pipeline office sort of dissolved a little bit, but then they reconstituted it and made it really integrated it more, working on the specific terms and conditions of the right of way, which the state and the federal right of ways pretty much mirrored each other.
Mm-hmm. And that's like so much on each side of the pipeline or the road, maybe the haul road too.
Well, the haul road was initially permitted by BLM, but was always envisioned and planned to be turned over to the state.
Okay.
And it was built by Alyeska.
Right.
Yeah, you know.
And it was initially not a public road, but then eventually it has become one.
It was always intended to become a public road.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
But initially it was just for the purposes of building the pipeline.
Yeah. Well, once something like the pipeline is put in, what is there to manage in terms of terms and conditions? You sort of think getting the permits to get it built was a whole complicated thing.
Yes, and restoring the surface, you know, and then maintaining that, there's brushing requirements, there's wildlife management requirements along there, there's access requirements for maintenance along the right of way, because, you know, part of it was above ground, part below ground, mm-hmm. and so there was a lot of maintenance issues along the line. And then, as the years go on, they detected corrosion, and mm-hmm. so that became a big issue, and there was a lot of work to figure out why it was corroding and to resolve that. And then they had a lot of projects to dig up corroded areas and inspect them and repair them if they needed to be and that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And so, and all of those projects needed to be permitted specifically because they would require additional area outside the right of way.
Okay.
And
did an EIS environmental review have to happen if they had to dig something up?
Well, for the first 30 years of the right of way, they were exempted from any NEPA. Congress had said the initial NEPA was sufficient, but when they renewed the right-of-way, Congress didn't carry that forward, so they mm-hmm. did need to start doing the NEPA documents after that, and so we would do all those documents too for all of their projects.
Okay. So. Yeah, I say, I always think, it's just all Alyeska does that, but you know, think about that. It's not really their land. They only own the pipeline.
Yeah, they own the pipeline, and they own the right to maintain that pipeline within that right-of-way. So.
Is that standard for pipelines?
Yeah.
That they don't own the land.
Right. That's true with all utilities, and, you know, they don't own the land. I mean, well, they own some land, like... like the terminal, they bought the land for the terminal.
Valdez.
You know, places like that, they'll But even like the pump stations, a lot of that is just use permits. Hmm. It's not, they don't own the underlying land.
Right, okay. Interesting. And so in your job as DSD, is that when sort of the Iditarod Trail came into your purview?
That's right. That's right.
Can you explain
that? As deputy state director, you're over all of the whole state in mm-hmm. terms of the resource and minerals programs, and you rely on your district people, managers, and specialists to, you know, plan and carry out the details of the work. But, you know, as a deputy, you do a lot of coordination with Washington and development of funding to carry out the work that's needed.
Mm-hmm.
And so working with the Anchorage manager, which had the responsibility for the Iditarod Trail system, and Mike Seidlitz was the trail coordinator at that time. And basically there was an agreement, because the Iditarod Trail system, you know, the majority of the land was probably state land. There was some native lands. There was private lands. There was Forest Service lands. So there was a variety of ownerships.
Mm-hmm.
And so there was a committee formed and a plan laid out to manage the whole trail system. And it was unique in that it also allowed for motorized vehicle use on the trail, which is why they can conduct like the Iron Dog mm-hmm. races and stuff like that. Now I'm not sure if there's a limitation on the size of vehicles or whatever,
weight of vehicle.
There is on a lot of the trails and systems that the Bureau has. They have weight limits
right.
and stuff. So I suspect there is on that, but I don't remember. I can't.
Yeah, but you're right. It would make sense. I mean, I know in Fairbanks area, the trails, they have seasonal limits, and now with those big side-by-sides,
right.
it's changing all the permitting. And
yeah, because the side-by-side, they're almost like
Little cars.
Four-wheel drive.
Yeah, that's what I think.
They're almost commercial vehicles.
Yeah.
They're as expensive as.
Yes, exactly. So when you got involved with the trail, it had already received its historic designation.
Yes.
And do you know why BLM was put in charge of the management? And it happened before you got there, but you know that background.
Yeah, of course, Interior, the Bureau of Outdoor
Recreation
or something, was at that time, did the big study in 77, I think it
yep.
was, that proposed the designation to Congress. And that was allowed due to a modification of the historic scenic trails law, actually,
mm-hmm.
to allow to incorporate historic
right.
trails too. And so this became a historic trail designation. And at the time, you know, BLM is the U.S. government's agency that disposes of federal lands. And so the majority of lands were technically still under BLM management, even though they were selected by state and native corporations. And so the process of transferring those was still occurring.
Oh, okay.
And having BLM and over all of that, I think, was the major reason for having BLM be the lead
okay.
agency with that for the federal government.
Yeah, it's sort of like federal lands, if they're not park, if they're not specifically designated as Park Service or Forest Service, sort of their generic BLM.
Or Fish and Wildlife Service.
Yes.
Or the, those are the four big agencies in the federal government.
Right. It sort of seems like BLM kind of is the catch-all for those miscellaneous federal lands.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you said that Mike was the trail coordinator. Who was the Anchorage manager at the time? Do you remember?
I can get it for you. I'm trying to think of his name. I have his name down in the other room.
Because Mike would have reported to the
him.
To him,
yeah.
And then
whatever. I would have coordinated with him.
Okay.
Yeah. And I talked to Mike several times directly, too, about, you know, one of the big concerns when I was there was actually trying to get protections on the lands that had already been conveyed to the state or the Native corporations to protect the trail right away itself from being built on or done, you know, something done with. And so that was a big part of the planning part at that time, was trying to identify and work with these particular agencies to establish designations. Of course, some of the areas already had been built over, roads or whatever had been built over them, and so that. Another big effort was, of course, trying to interpret and make people aware of what the values were that we were trying to maintain the system for. And
so some education.
Yeah, education component. And putting up, you know, where do you put up displays? When do you, you know, how do you... How do you make the public aware of these values and that? And then that was all being kind of overshadowed by the Iditarod race itself, which is, of course, the big event, the international event that's drawn so much attention to this system. And then... You know, there was a primary route, and then there were a lot of side trails and stuff that were used mostly by local natives and miners in the local areas, so going between villages and towns and mining camps and districts. For a lot of those side trails, that was what those were for. So.
And those side trails, are they not incorporated into the Iditarod Trail designation?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, they are. I'm not sure that all of the land owners totally like or agree with all of that, even today.
Yeah.
I don't know, since I've left, how much headway's been made with that, but... but you know that, but they are historic routes and trails that were used back in those days, and you know, I think it's good that they are recognized and noted and protected as much as we can.
Now, would, if it crosses private land, then is there trail easement that somebody could put in, or?
Well, if the private landowner would allow one to be established, you know, and could there could be some legal agreement put in place to protect that, you know, that's what we would strive to accomplish through that committee, working with those, and you know. It's just like, it would be just like any resource development company, like an oil and gas company or a coal company or anybody else that's going on private land. you know, can we use this for this purpose, and this is what we'll pay you, or what, you know, this is what the agreement will be for your compensation for us using this part of your land.
Oh, so BLM had funding to...
Well, we continually seek funding for that, and, you know, I mean, Congress does have its limitations in how much it allots year by year, but the idea is to identify things, specific projects that you can budget out and then submit requests to Congress for funding for those. The state agencies would do the same on the state side with their state agencies. I don't know that the Park Service has any specific lands on the Iditarod Trail system, but the Fish and Wildlife Service does. Mm-hmm. And so they would, and the Forest Service
does on the southern end that you
yes,
get.
Yes, and they've been actively pursuing, really
right,
identifying and marking and protecting the trail, and, you know, interpreting it for mm-hmm. the public use and stuff. So,
so when you were with BLM, the Deputy State Director, what kind of projects were being worked on related to the trail? Because you said you identify projects and then seek the funding.
Yeah, a lot of them when I was there were related to the race.
Oh, really?
The Iditarod race, yeah. And so the cabins along the trail that facilitated and helped with the race were big projects that were funded to maintain and build those cabins. Marking of the trails, getting funding to mark the trails, and then establishing the legal documents to protect the right-of-way itself. Those were the big projects that we were working on.
Well, yeah, I was wondering if... So it's designated a National Historic Trail, but it doesn't have a protected right-of-way?
No.
How does that work? So it was designated a trail on a map?
Because some of it was already conveyed to, you know, wasn't in federal ownership.
Okay.
You know, that hadn't been conveyed, that's where our conveyance division would come in. When they would convey the lands, they would specifically put into the legal document a protection for that.
Okay.
And the conveyance documents. And so that's where Wayne Bowden and Ramona Chin and those folks would come in terms of, being able to identify that right away in the transfer documents, so that it's a protected right there.
Okay.
But being able to get the agencies or the private owners who already had those lands agree to have that right away and protect it,
mm-hmm.
you know, that's, you just work on that.
Right.
You know, through the years.
So even though the trail was really already there before they claimed the land,
yeah.
that didn't protect the trail.
No, yeah, not necessarily. Yeah. You know, the natives, they used different routes over the years, and, you know, as things changed, I'm sure they changed routes
right.
here and there. But, you know, and then, but some of those areas were improved along there, you know, to be maintained more actively.
Mm-hmm.
And so those, you know, are a little easier to establish those legal documents for and
mm-hmm.
be able to do it. But.
And so when you came on, the trail had already been surveyed, and so people kind of knew where that route was, because you needed that for the designation, probably.
Yeah, I mean, they had in the designation, you know, they had lines drawn on maps to show where the trail was. I don't know if there was an actual legal description, you know, surveyed description
mm-hmm.
of that. that's part of what they would work on as they develop the.
Yeah, areas. Now that I think about it, I think that maybe came afterwards.
Yeah, a lot of that does come afterwards.
Okay.
And I think it was true to things like the Lewis and Clark and the Appalachian Trail system. You know, those all had a lot of development along, you know, and they had to come in afterwards and, you know, establish that too, I think. Mm-hmm. So, well, I mean, it's not unusual. I mean, that's typically how it is.
Right. And as you say, especially in the Anchorage area, you know, the trail was built over, there was highways, and so you kind of have to make a new route somehow, connect the two pieces.
Yeah. And it's the same with, like, designation of park lands or Fish and Wildlife Service lands. I mean, a lot of times there's inholdings in those, and you have to work with those inholding people, you know, to eventually, you know, once you've completed or buy them out outright, you know.
Right.
They've done that, too.
Right.
But, you know, so over time, you perfect that land status and use, and that's what the plan and the committee is all about, is to do that, is to help perfect that process and that right-of-way system, and interpret it, mark it, designate it, you know, that kind of thing.
And how well or not well did that work coordinating with all those different entities?
Well, it's always an up and down as personalities come and go and different people work on it, and different people see opportunities to advance different pieces of it. But I think overall, it works really well. I mean, I, you know, you got people working together. They all sort of have the same goal, or understand at least what Congress's intention was, and work toward it as best they can. You know, and I don't know all of the roadblocks or details of all of those pieces. You know, it's the longest trail system in the United States still, I think.
Is it?
The Lewis Clark might be longer now, but I think
it's longer than the Appalachian or the Pacific Crest, but they're not designated.
They're scenic trails. They're not historic trails.
Right.
It's the longest historic trail.
Okay.
I know that. But I don't know if it's the longest trail system itself.
Right.
But
anyway, it's long.
Yeah, yeah. But, yeah, I mean, it's an awesome project to be a part of, and kind of wrap your head around all the history that goes in behind it, and, you know, it's amazing.
Yeah. So what were, is there anything you can think of that you'd consider successes during your time at BLM? Related to the trail?
Yeah, I think one of the biggest ones was, for me, was seeing the Forest Service really, while I was there, that's when they began to really initiate designating and improving sections of the trail system. So that was a big part of it. Marking the trails, there was a lot of areas that we were able to get marked with tripods and flags and things along the trail, which really helped and facilitated the race system. And I think that was a big motivator behind that part of it. And, you know, the cabins along the trail. I saw a couple of those built and a couple of them kind of refurbished and improved on. And so that was, you know, it was always fun to be a part of those projects, you know, because being a mechanical engineer, I'm a visual person. I could see something, like, you know, you could touch it, feel it. You know? it had dimension.
Right. You see the cabin go up.
Yeah.
Right.
Where, you know, somebody signs a piece of paper that says, this is your right of way. You know, you don't see that as visually as you do a cabin or markers on the trail or, you know, interpretive signage or things like that.
Yeah.
So.
Well, I find it interesting that you guys were marking the trail because, I mean, the Iditarod started in 1973, so it had been going for 20-some years, and yeah. Wasn't the trail marked?
Well, they do mark trails for that, too, and but then, you know, there's always improvements in that, you know, and, the markers back at the beginning weren't as... Good okay.
You upgraded from a blaze on the side of a tree to tripods.
Tripods and and flag markers.
Well, yeah, and certainly out on the sea ice sections or those northern sections where there are no trees, a tripod is much better.
Yeah, and there's and then there's the maintenance of all of that, and because the weather is extreme in some of those areas. Mm-hmm. And of course, across the Norton Sound, you have to put them up every year, after the ice freeze. So there's a lot to that, and I don't know that people really realize how much effort goes into that, and how many volunteers are, need to be honored and thanked for all their service that they've done for that.
Do you have some in mind?
I don't know. Names of all those people, but I know in all those villages along the road there were people that helped out with all of that, people with snow machines that would pack down the trail and put up the markers, people from the villages that would house people that come along and along the trail, whether it's the racers or the workers that assisted the racers. All of that is key to history and the preservation of that system.
Yeah, well, it certainly seemed like the Iditarod sled dog race seems to be the biggest user of the trail.
Sure.
And all the people involved in making that race happen, like setting the trail with snow machines and the checkpoints in the villages and all that. Were there people in the villages who helped with the BLM projects?
We tried to get volunteers from the villages, to help with those projects. And, it would provide them with a lot of times summer employment or in the wintertime running their snow machines out to mark to put out the tripods and stuff, And we had field people in Nome as well as in Anchorage that, kind of worked it from both ends, to coordinate those activities.
Okay.
And, towards the end of my tenure there as deputy state director, is when they started things like the Iron Dog and the bicycle race.
Oh, right.
I did a race or the...
Well, yeah, it started out as the I did a ski.
And I did a ski and I did a bike or
something. Right, I did a bike and now it's the...
They still do the bike.
They still do it, but it has a different name, though.
Yeah, yeah. And I don't think they go all the way to Nome.
Some people do.
Boy, that's a long way to go.
This year, I know there were two people who bicycled all the way to Nome.
Oh, wow.
With those fat tire bikes.
Yeah, yeah. That's a challenge.
Yeah, a lot of people end in McGrath.
Yeah.
Well, and then again, they're taking advantage of a packed down, maintained, marked trail.
Yeah, yeah. Well, otherwise, I don't know if they'd make it.
That was one of the things I was going to ask is, we all associate the trail with the dog race and... Who else is using it?
Yeah. Well, originally it was the miners and the natives.
Right.
Natives for subsistence and just, inter-community functions and travel
right.
and stuff like that. But the miners specifically, a lot of those trails were improved and built upon to carry supplies for the mining communities.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what really solidified a lot of the main trail and why it was the main trail designation.
Right.
But I think, rightly, they did recognize a lot of those side trails as being valuable and important to the history of the system.
Yeah. So. Well, yeah, you got from Seward to Iditarod as a minor, but then maybe you traveled over to Flat or to Ophir or Ruby or something. Yeah,
or up to Caltag or something.
Yeah, and also getting supplies in from the Yukon from Ruby might be easier than coming all the way from here.
Yeah. Well, and over, you know, over the years with the mining, you know, they kind of fussed around with different routes to try to get the best routes. And,
right.
And a lot of it depended on where the activity was, too. I mean, that's from Seward to really over to Hope. When Hope really kind of took off was where that route was really developed. Because before, they were going up more up over out of, they were coming in by boat out of Whittier and then going up over the top there.
Oh.
And, you know, that's a pretty steep climb up out of there,
yeah,
up over that. But coming out of Seward became much easier.
Yeah.
To get in there.
I mean, Turnagain Pass isn't particularly easy. Well, I guess going to Hope, it would be before Turnagain, so it's a little easier.
Yeah, but, you know, coming up out through Moose Pass out of Seward was a little easier, wasn't as steep.
Mm-hmm. Well, and did they go across Kenai Lake?
I don't know if they went across the lake itself. They might have, you know.
I don't know the exact route down there.
Yeah, I think the Forest Service is really...
Yeah.
And the state would be the ones to...
Yeah. I know it crosses Crow Pass over into Eagle River. I know that much.
Yeah, that was a kind of a tough one. That was a pretty steep climb up to the top of Crow Pass.
And, yeah.
But then it was a long, easy glide down to the river down to...
Well, yeah, and nowadays, is most of the trail use wintertime?
The northern part is. The southern part here, I think, is mostly summer
use. Oh, for hikers.
Yeah. They run a race from Girdwood to the Eagle River Visitor Center every year.
Oh, like the Crow Pass run marathon.
Yeah.
Thing. Yeah.
My brother-in-law actually did that one year. That's a lot of, a long run.
Yeah, long run. And, well, you had mentioned the, I forgot what it, the one thing you mentioned I was going to ask about. The Iron Dog and the motorized access.
Uh-huh.
Was that controversial?
I don't think it's been that controversial. I mean... Because they've used snow machines along that route for a long time. They, mm-hmm, even the natives have begun, you know, they began using snow machines for subsistence purposes. And so I don't think the use of snow machines is controversial on there.
So that the Iron Dog and the permit for that was before your tenure, or did that happen during your time?
Towards the end of my tenure, they started running that as... Because
they had to get a permit, right, for BLM?
Yeah. You have to get a permit if there's a commercial side to it. In other words, if somebody can make money off of the event or the activity, then you need a permit.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, you wouldn't need a permit. I mean, I could get on my snow machine,
right,
and go out there without a permit. But if I was going to conduct an event where somebody might get gain from it, then, mm-hmm, I would need a permit.
And then what goes into the decision making about whether a permit is authorized? I mean, do you have to do an environmental impact review?
Yeah, they do it's usually an EA, an
environmental assessment.
Yeah, an environmental assessment is, they usually don't need to do a full EIS because there's not that big of impact. And an EA will identify the environmental conditions and what the limits are to prevent, mm-hmm, damage.
And then is there public comment on
Yeah,
that?
there's a 30-day comment period on an EA too.
Yeah, and that's what I was wondering, if there was any opposition and public comment.
I'm not aware that there was ever any when I was there. I don't know the issues, mm-hmm, since I've left there.
Okay.
So...
And the sled dog race must have to get a permit every year, or are they grandfathered in?
No, they get a permit. They have to go in and renew it every year.
Mm-hmm.
But over the years, there's been a few things that have changed, sometimes the conditions are such that they need to move the location of starting. They've done that at times,
right,
to protect the environment and that kind of thing. So,
mm-hmm. And is there a fee for that permit?
Yes, there are fees for that. Yeah. I don't know what they are.
No, but that there is a fee.
Yeah.
Normally with permits, yeah. So you said BLM would maintain the trail. So how did they do that?
Well, they work with a committee of all those agencies,
mm-hmm,
to do that and identify, if there's areas that are being impacted too much, they need to go in and restore them. They will identify those areas and what's needed to restore it or improve it, and then they will seek the funding for it. And when, mm-hmm, they get the funding, then they'll seek volunteers or hire people to go out and do the work to maintain it.
Mm-hmm.
Whatever that work is, whether it's improving the, maybe it's a little swampy area and it's getting torn up, and mm-hmm, so they might put down some mats or something to protect the soil and keep people from sinking in and tearing up the ground.
Just like restoring a hiking trail in the tundra.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Or maybe it's, in a mountainous area where the side is sloughing off and they, mm-hmm, need to reinforce the bank there or something to keep it from sloughing off and, protect people from going over the edge and,
right,
getting injured.
And did they do brushing out and stuff too? I don't know how quickly it grows in.
Yeah, there'll be brushing projects too, along different areas of it.
Every year?
No, usually it's not every year. If you do a good job of brushing, it may be 5 years or so before you need to go back in and do it again. Sometimes it depends on how much use a trail gets too. If you get a lot of use on a trail, tend to keep the brushing back.
Even on a winter trail?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
On a winter trail, a lot of it depends on the snowpack, how much snow you get. And if you get enough snow, then, that protects some of the vegetation too.
Right.
So.
Yeah, and I know in some places the BLM seasonality of use is,
yeah,
seasonal and snow-based, because, like, for snow machines to protect the vegetation.
Right.
So that would also apply to the Iditarod Trail.
Yeah, and that also, grooming the trail is another thing, to protect that and keep it, particularly where you're using snow machines and stuff like that, you want to groom it to, otherwise you get a lot of washboarding. And,
oh, right.
And it really can tear up the bottoms of all those washes, you can really start tearing up vegetation.
Yeah. And so who does the trail grooming?
They'll either contract it and have people come in, or they'll have staffing that goes out, weekly or so and grooms it.
But BLM staff?
Could be BLM, it could be state,
okay,
employees doing their sections, or Forest Service people doing theirs. It depends on the ownership of the land.
Okay. Oh, yeah, I didn't know that if just people in the local communities went out and groomed it.
They could, have agreements with those people, mm-hmm, to go out and do it and, compensate them in some fashion.
Well, and I was also thinking before the Iditarod race, they must do a major grooming, and I just assumed that was the race committee.
The race committee works with the local managers to do that, and the timing of it, and a lot of it's done by volunteers.
Right.
and they get people to come in. And those volunteers are usually local people, you know.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
They know their section of trail.
Yeah. And a lot of them do it year after year, and they know, you know, they know, okay, it's that time of year again, and get ready, you know, let's go out and do our run. And
right. Yeah, well, and you certainly hear stories of people out on the trail, and there's a big snowstorm, and then there's no more trail.
Yeah. I think the biggest opposition that I've had when I was there was really the animal protection people. I'm trying to think.
PETA.
PETA?
People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals.
Yeah. And their big worry was the treatment of the race dogs, mm-hmm. you know. Not so much the trail itself and the use of the trail, but really, I mean, but that's what we, you know, were faced with, was all of that opposition.
Right, for a permit.
And working with the race people and saying, making sure they were addressing all those issues in their, you know, so mm-hmm. we could permit them to do it.
Right.
So.
So those trail shelters, the cabins, what's the purpose of those?
Well, there's various purposes, because they're used both summer and winter by various people, but they're basically shelters. They're considered in some respects emergency shelters. Mm-hmm. If somebody gets out there and, you know, gets in trouble, they can utilize those shelters to, you know, save their lives, basically, right. If they get in a storm or get caught or something. So there's multiple purposes for those shelters, but they also serve as checkpoints for the race system, too.
I didn't know that. I thought the checkpoints were all in villages.
No, I think like the Roan Roadhouse, Roan Cabin mm-hmm. is one of BLM's cabins. It's okay. A checkpoint. And I, you know, that I remember specifically, but I thought there was a couple of them.
I don't know.
Those were the, you know, the purposes.
And what goes, what is the sort of standard size, and how are they outfitted? Do they have wood in them, for instance? Or?
Yeah, BLM maintains them. They provide a wood stock for firewood, and so they're supplied with bunks and a stove and a place to sit and eat. You know, they have a logbook for people to sign in and express their thoughts about the cabin and the trail and all of that, you know, and so those are, you know, might be interesting to read one of those and see what people write about the whole thing.
Know? And where are those kept? They're kept at the BLM office here?
Well, they're kept at the cabin, and then at the end of the year they bring them in, and, you know, they store that information at the BLM, the local Anchorage office, mm-hmm. field office. So
yeah,
that's where those would be.
So they're just like regular public use cabins.
Yeah.
Do you have to make a reservation? like you do at some public use cabins?
I don't know if they do out on there. I know they were talking about it, because like they do in the White Mountains mm-hmm. for the cabins they have there. They do have a reservation because there's so much use of them. I don't know that out along the Iditarod they get as much use, and I don't know if they have to reserve them.
Right, that's what I was wondering.
They just have to let BLM know, hey, I'm going to be out there. Is there anybody else going to be there, you know?
Yeah.
Kind of thing.
But well, and who restocks the firewood? I mean, like, I know the White Mountains,
BLM
does it, but the Iditarod Trail, those seem so remote.
Well, BLM would, you know, they'll fly out there and service those cabins and, you know, make sure they're stocked with firewood and kept up and stuff,
mm-hmm.
you know. A lot of times if volunteers are coming out there or whatever, they'll do some, you know, they'll say, hey, you know, what's the conditions out there? Low on firewood or whatever, you know, hey. Or if somebody's going out, they'll say, well, you know, what needs to be done out here?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and they'll talk to the BLM manager and they'll say, well, if you can do this or that, that'd be helpful. And then they'll report back and say, yeah, I did this and that, and you got this now, you know. So there's a lot of that camaraderie and communication back and forth that mm-hmm. helps maintain those cabins.
I was thinking during your time as deputy state director, there were lots of projects going on with the minerals and the resources. And where did the trail fall into that? I mean, how much of a priority is the Iditarod Trail compared to the other things?
Well, I think it's as... You know, that's hard to say because from year to year, priorities shift around. Mm-hmm. But there was a specific funding category for the trail, you know, for that. And so the field office had they have a person who's designated to specifically focus on the trail and coordinate with the other agencies on that and generate funding for that.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, I would say it has, you know, a high level of importance with the agency. You know, would I say it's as high as some of the other projects from year to year? No. But in other times, yes. It varies from year to year.
Yeah, I just wonder, you know.
But is it ever just like forgotten, set aside? No. There's somebody there working with it year to year, day in, day out.
Yeah, the fact that they had a designated trail administrator staff position, I find amazing, really.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's... you know, if you're going to have a national trail system, you need to have somebody who's going to be over that and, you know, be able to work with all the other partners in terms of what needs to be done and how to do that. Otherwise, you really, I mean, you only have a designation and name only.
Right.
I mean, otherwise, you don't really have much.
Right. And I was wondering if that's what I'm surprised that BLM took it on and implemented it and didn't just have it in name only.
No, it's a requirement of the law to have somebody do that and
okay.
be there. So, I mean, you know, when Congress designated it, they committed to provide funding for that position and to push that forward and work with the other agencies. 'Cause, you know, when you make a designation, like, you know, there's a lot of work ahead.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot to that. And it's, you know, you can't just say it's there and then ignore it. You got to do something with it. And I think they've done a commendable job.
So the BLM administration, did they ever feel like, oh, this trail is such a nuisance and it's a thorn in our side?
No. No, I don't think they view it like that at all. I think they view it as an opportunity. And I think they enjoy working with the other agencies. And, you know, there's always challenges, but they were committed to work with that. And I think they're doing a great job at it.
Mm-hmm.
So,
do you have examples of some of those challenges?
Well, the permitting is probably one of the bigger ones, you know, making sure mm-hmm. that you have that. Funding from the various different agencies is another challenge, you
mm-hmm.
know. That, and then, you know, just the working with the different events and the people from those events are, you know, the details of all of that can sometimes be a little challenging.
Mm-hmm.
But, I think we've always met that head on and, you know, tried to find solutions that work for everybody.
Any specific challenges that you dealt with when you were in the position?
You'd have to talk to Mike more specifically about mm-hmm. that, but the thing that I remember was there were some issues with regard to in the permitting process for the Iditarod mm-hmm. events, how the Iditarod committee really calculated their profits and assets and all of that, which is what determined their fees for their permit and some of that stuff. And so there were some challenges working through the details of that so that everybody was on the same page mm-hmm. as to what was really what on that.
Right.
So, because, you know, anytime they're making a profit off of that, it, you know, if you're making millions of dollars and paying peanuts for the right to do that, you know, as opposed to somebody else who's making maybe thousands of dollars and paying hundreds of dollars for for a permit, you know. So that's, those challenges are the balance of what that was all about.
Mm-hmm. Well, as the deputy state director, maybe some things didn't rise to your level.
A lot of that was handled by the local field office. Mm-hmm. You know, they did most of that. I mean, what come to my level a lot of times was, once the field office had said, hey, you know, here's what we need in our budget next year to be able to accomplish these projects, and, you know, I would work with Washington staff to ensure that the budget included those things mm-hmm. and, you know, try to ensure that carried through so that when the budget came out, we had funding specifically for those projects.
So you had to balance requests for the trail with requests for
All the other resources.
Yeah.
And there's 26 or so different funding streams that all vied for dollars.
So how did you make those decisions?
Well, it's a planning process, and, you know, you'd meet together with the different field offices and talk about priorities, and you would talk about funding, and that, you know, you'd set up standards and stuff as to, you know, okay, how are we going to judge all these mm-hmm. things, and then you would throw all that stuff in the hat. Each field office would throw their stuff in, and you'd meet together, and, you know, so all of the outdoor people would get together from the different field offices and go through all their different projects and rank them all and say, okay, here's our priorities on these things, and then that would carry forward, and we'd put together a state budget, and that would go to Washington, and then they would compete with all the other states
right.
for their projects, you know, from the, and so that, it was a who's the best salesman?
Well, that's going to say it's a lobbying effort on the
could
sell their project up the line.
And a lot of times, you know, we have managers who like to have what they call shelf-ready projects, so that they had staffed it all out and priced it all out and had plans on the shelf, and so if money come through, they could pull these plans off the shelf and say, we're ready to go, mm-hmm. and we can use that money and go. And so we encouraged them to do that.
That gave them a slight advantage in the process.
Yeah. Yep.
Yeah. Well, it sounds like a tough position to have to be making all those decisions and balancing all that lobbying from the staff.
Yeah, well, it's a communication process, and, you know, relationship building. You know, if I get you this money, are you really going to do this project, or are you just trying to pad your books for something else that you want to do, you know? And so you build those relationships and those trusts, and then the other thing is if you're partnering with another agency, and you can push that forward and say, hey, you know, here's the project we need to get done, and it involves these three agencies, and these guys are providing their funding, we need to provide ours, and so you had a little more stroke that way. And so it, it's it was all old strategizing and planning, and then really understanding the importance of different projects. You know, is this really significant, or can I wait another year on this? You know, mm-hmm. and that's always a balancing project.
Were
and I'm sure you're used to it.
I am. Were there times when a project was planned with multiple agencies and another agency didn't come up with the funding for their share?
Oh, yeah.
And then what?
Well, then you go back to the drawing board and adjust and figure out, you know, okay, here's what we do have, here's what we can get done, and then maybe this piece we have to wait until next year or whatever the other agency gets their funding, or maybe we can come up with some donation somewhere to cover that part of it. Mm-hmm. You know, you look for lots of different opportunities, and things throughout the year would change. You know, I mean, you get the plan at the beginning of the year, you get funding, and then something happens on a project and it gets stalled out, and so now you have this money for this project A, but you can't do project A for some particular reason, and so can I shift that money over and accomplish this project here, and then when that problem on the other one gets worked out, then I can shift money back over mm-hmm. on another year to cover that project. And so that's a part of the internal workings of, you know, throughout the year too on projects that mm-hmm. you deal with.
Did it ever happen that BLM, you got the money for a BLM project on the trail, and then BLM didn't, the staff that was supposed to do the project didn't do it?
I found that at the local level they were very committed to doing those things, and unless they were overridden by upper management, they got it done.
So how would that happen, then, get overridden by upper management? What does that mean?
Say suddenly out of Congress, for example, would say all of a sudden they've got some big high priority thing that they roll down and they tell Interior, okay, you need to get this done, and you need to get it done now. And Interior goes, okay, BLM, we're shifting some of your money, and all of a sudden you don't have the money you thought you had mm-hmm. because they've jerked it over for something else.
I see.
You know, and if Congress chooses to do that, or if the Secretary of Interior, or who, you know, as it rolls down the hill, you don't have much flexibility there. And so you roll with it,
right,
and you work it. But usually when the money gets down to your level, they don't mess with it too much, and you're able to do what you need to do.
At the local level who were doing these projects, they were pretty much independent? There wasn't a lot of oversight?
Well, yeah, they were pretty independent, but they just had to answer at the end of the year. I mean, mm-hmm. if you or provide money to them and you know, over the course of a few years, you know, somebody from Washington comes out and he wants to see all this stuff you've been doing, and you haven't been doing it, you're not going to get any more money. I mean, it's,
yeah.
You know, they learn pretty quickly that, you know, if they're not getting stuff done, they're not getting money in the next years.
Okay. So. And would people get fired if they didn't get stuff done?
Well, they definitely got, I don't know that they get fired, but they definitely get disciplined.
Oh, I was going to say, or they get reappointed to a different region.
Yeah, they get their wings trimmed pretty good. So, yeah, no, it's a give and take and working relationships. You have some people that are better at it than others, and you know, Alaska's a particular challenge. You know, we had I think a more than challenging effort to convince Washington that we needed more dollars to do these projects because of our remote mm-hmm. nature. It was a lot more expensive to do the stuff up here than in the lower 48. And so their tendency was to fund stuff in the lower 48 because they could get so much more done with the dollars than they could in Alaska mm-hmm. because it's so much more expensive. And, you know, you say, well, I'm going to do this project out in out of Nome. And so you got to fly all this stuff into Nome. And then you get to Nome and you got to get a helicopter contract to go out to the field to do this. And you get to Nome and the weather's bad. And you can't fly in a helicopter. And so you sit in Nome for 3 days. And you're burning money.
Right.
Sitting in Nome. You're burning money on the helicopter contract. You're burning money on the hotels and the food and, you know, all of that stuff. And then maybe you run out of money and you can't get the project done.
Right.
And then Washington says, well, what the heck happened? Well, the weather beat me, you know.
Right.
It's just like the guy on the pipeline told us one time on the projects when we were replacing a valve project. He says, sometimes the bear gets you and sometimes you get the bear.
It's true. I was going to say the benefit of being weathered out in Nome and lot, you know, all that stuff, you help the local economy a little bit, put some money back in.
Yeah, yeah. And sometimes, you know, you spend 2 or 3 days and then you were able to get out and you get the project done.
Right.
But it's still a higher cost than you had budgeted for and planned for.
Yeah, and I was thinking all the trail work that BLM does on the Iditarod Trail, whether it's the shelters or the marking the trail. You must have had to use a lot of helicopters for that.
We do a lot of helicopter work. We do a lot of point-to-point flights.
Okay.
You know, flying stuff. We do a lot of ATV, snow machine. A lot of those kind of skills are needed. So
coming out, like you'd fly to McGrath and then snow machine.
And then you take a snow machine out from there, or, you know, something like that. More,
yeah.
So, yeah, I mean...
And that's more expensive than the lower 48 and just driving to a trailhead.
Yeah, I mean, in the lower 48, a lot of those people can get up in the morning, get in their truck, drive out to the site, do the project, come home and sleep at home at night.
Right.
Where we have to book a flight, we have to pay the freight to get the stuff there, we have to book hotel nights, pay per diem, and some of the per diem in some of these places is 2 or 3 times higher than the lower 48 anyway. Plus, and they're not doing any of that on top of that. So it's, yeah, and, you know, once you get some trust built up with Washington and you bring them out and, I remember people calling me from Washington and say, the secretary of so-and-so wants to come to Alaska. They're going to be coming through Alaska and they want to go see this and this and this. And my first question to them is, well, how long are they going to be there? Well, they're going to be there overnight. And I say, well, then they're not going to be able to see this and this. They might be able to see this. Well, why? Well, because if you want to go see this, you got to book a flight out, and there's one flight a day that goes, and it leaves at this time of the day, and it goes there, and then you're going to overnight, and... because you can't catch a flight back if you're going to go see this because it goes there and then comes back. And so you got to wait till the next day to come back. And then when you get there, it's weather dependent. If the weather's good, you're going to be able to go see. Okay. If not, you've gone there and back and you don't see anything.
Or if you're going to a village and something occurs in the village,
they may not
be there. They're not available. That's the other thing that happens, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's very unpredictable.
Or you plan on a 10 o'clock meeting, and they show up at 3 in the afternoon.
Right. Or they don't have a quorum.
Because that's their time frame.
Right.
So it's helping Washington understand some of those logistics.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we had the Secretary of Interior one time say he was going to come up and walk around some lake up on MPRA. Well, you know, that's like a 5-day journey to walk around this lake. You really going to do that? I mean, you really think you're going to, you know?
Yeah. It's definitely that leads into education, and I was thinking about educating the public about the historic nature of the Iditarod Trail, because, you know, so many people, they know about the dog race.
Yeah.
But it seems like the public in Alaska, I don't think they knew the history of the trail and that it has a trail designation.
Oh, yeah. And what they don't know is the early history of the natives and the mining, you know, and the how these communities become so populated and gone, and then, you know, and the natives, you know, warring back and forth between their little villages and
right.
groups too, you know, and the trails they used for that, and the subsistence things that occurred, and what mm-hmm. they were. What were they really hunting and looking for? You know, the berries, the plants, the game, mm-hmm. you know, the different things like that. And the miners, you know, how did they get their supplies? How did they, you know, I mean, that was a big thing. If you're going to mine, it's one thing to go out there with your little donkey and a backpack and
right.
camp, you know. I mean, that's what I think most America thinks of miners, is these little onesie twosies with donkeys and
right.
going out. And then, well, up here that wasn't a lot of that.
Right.
I mean, it was a dog sled team and a big back, and then you had, you know, and how did you get your mail, and how did, you know, a lot of different things.
Yeah, and those sleds were heavy. They had a lot of freight they
oh,
were
yeah.
carrying.
Yeah.
Yeah. Is that an airplane? I guess so.
Yep.
Yep. Well, that's what I was thinking, is that the dog sled race sort of helped publicize the trail. It gave
right.
people connection. That.
Yeah, well, that's the, you know, the connection started, I think, with the serum run
mm-hmm.
when they had the epidemic. And, you know, because those trails had been improved and they were able to use the dog sleds to get the serum to those villages and save a lot of lives. And then sometime later, Joe Reddington, you know, kind of promoted that as a route for a race
mm-hmm.
To kind of commemorate that whole thing, and tied that Iditarod race to that, because that was kind of one of the major routes for the serum run. And so I think that was a connection for the how the racing came to be, and then that sort of launched it internationally. You know, you started getting races from all around the world coming
mm-hmm.
for this big race and the competition. And
yeah, I mean, I think now, you know, I tell people, oh, I'm working on this project about the Iditarod Trail, and they immediately just think it's
the
race. I think most Alaskans probably don't know that it's designated as a historic trail.
Right.
So what has BLM done to try and change that view?
Well, you know, I think your interpretive analysis and signage, you know, marking the trails and putting up, you know, that this is a National Historic Trail markers, so that people recognize us. And then in your BLM's done a lot with mapping and putting out maps available to the public to allow them to, you know, go online and act, so, oh, hey, here's somewhere I could go, and here's the, you know, starting point, and, you know, I can go hike this portion.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, with that comes some interpretation of what it is, and that, and the, you know, and the different agencies, you know, getting them to recognize it as a historic trail system and to mark it accordingly too. You go on the internet and you look up the Iditarod Trail, the first thing you're going to get is a dog race.
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
right.
But are you going to find a National Historic Trail? I mean, if you type that in, are they going to... Iditarod National Historic Trail, and you know, you can find the report
right
that they did that proposed a designation to that. Has a lot of good information mm-hmm. in it, stuff, but
yeah, I was wondering if during your tenure were there any particular interpretive education things you remember that got accomplished?
No, we were at the beginning of trying to get the right-of-way secured more. Mm-hmm. I mean, that was the bigger focus when I was there, was really okay. You know, trying to secure the rights to the right-of-way so that you could protect it. And from there, then you're able to begin to improve and mark and establish, because without that right-of-way, it's pretty hard to go onto those lands and put up markers or interpretive signage or anything to, mm-hmm. you know, so that when the public is there, they see it as a historic trail rather than just another trail that the dogs are running
right.
on.
Is there any interpretive signage at the beginning of the trail or out in Nome?
There is at in Seward on.
Oh, there is
Miles
in Seward.
Hour,
right,
Mile
I've been
Zero.
There.
There is in.
I was thinking, like in Willow or.
Yeah, there
or
is
someplace.
At Willow and Knick. There's some interpretive places there. And you know, when you go on the web, I mean, they're working to improve websites that mm-hmm. You know, let people know a little bit about it and what the history is, and you know, areas that are accessible for them to, if they want to hike or if they want to snow machine or ski or whatever, mm-hmm. you know, what uses are easy or more difficult to do.
Right. And a lot of that all happens at the trail administrator level,
yeah.
probably than where you were at.
Yeah, yeah, it is. And it's all done through this cooperative agreement and committee
mm-hmm.
that works, you know, because you want it all to be coordinated. You know, you don't want all these agencies kind of going off on their own.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you want to keep it coordinated, and that's the role of BLM, is to kind of keep that coordinated.
Yeah, I've always assumed that because BLM has a trail administrator and is kind of a quote-unquote manager of the trail, I didn't realize there was a committee.
There is a committee, and that's a strong part, because the majority of it isn't owned by BLM. Majority of it's probably owned by the state.
Okay.
The Forest Service has a big portion in the southern, and the Fish and Wildlife Service has a big portion out in the flats towards the west coast. And the native villages out there. So
do they have representation on the committee?
Yeah.
Okay.
All those entities are represented in that committee and work together to establish the priorities and the goals and how they can help each other achieve different things. What the central message they want to put out is, how they want it to appear, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I find that very interesting that it's because of all the landowners that there has to be this committee.
Yeah. Well, and, you know, I haven't looked into these other scenic trail systems, but I'd imagine there's a committee with those people, too. That,
no idea.
You know, there's probably a designated lead agency, but I'm sure there's a group of people from different entities, ownerships, that are having their voice in how the trail's managed.
Even though the BLM's the lead agency, they don't just go ahead and make their own decisions because they're the lead?
No. Well, they can on their own lands.
Okay.
You know, I mean, as can any other agency, you know. But the idea of the committee is to, you know, are we all achieving the same goal? I mean, you know, and to kind of make sure we're staying in line with what Congress designated the purpose of the trail for.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, what its values are, and how do we interpret those values? How do we educate people on those values? How do we, you know, that's to me the purpose of the committee, is to coordinate all those things and, you know, enhance that through community cooperation and effort.
Yeah, and I guess most recreational trails are shorter, and they're therefore within the boundaries of a national park or within the Forest Service. This is unusual because it crosses so many entities.
Right. Yeah.
So, yeah, the Park Service has a recreational trail on their land. They don't need to consult with anybody else. It's their land.
Yeah, I mean, they look for input, but they make the decisions.
Right.
Yeah. And the same with the committee's looking for input from the public and from other people, you know. But they're also, after they get all that input and weigh it, you know, they're making the decisions on, you know, the priorities and what to do, because their objective and purpose is to protect those designated purposes and rights. So.
And what about the Historic Trail Alliance? Well, it used to be the Iditarod Trail Advisory Council, and then it became the Trail Alliance. What is their role? How did BLM coordinate and work with them?
Well, I think that morphed into the committee. I mean, that's what, you know, ultimately transitioned into the representation from all these owners and forming the committee. But, you know, the alliance would have, you know, taken what Congress put into law and defined, clarified the mapping and made sure, you know, start that process. But it's really the committee and that agreement. They probably were the ones that were instrumental in putting the first initial agreement together among all those agencies that formed the committee. And,
I think I was thinking BLM coordinated with the Trail Alliance, like on the cabins. The Trail Alliance people help with that, for instance.
Yeah. Well, they would have had input on that. And, you know, but because there's more purposes than those that are involved in the historic trail, you know, BLM would have, you know, had maybe a little more weighty decision making in that but they would have certainly listened to the alliance and the committee in that to, you know, make sure it aligned with their goals too.
Is there any projects related to the trail that you wish could have been done while you were there?
I would have wished that we could have got farther along in the process of designating the specific rights, you know, protections, because that's so key. That's kind of the starting point, you know.
Right. Yeah, that's interesting what you said about that.
Yeah, you need that document in order to really grant the permission to move forward with some of the other things, you know. And otherwise you stand the chance of, you know, you go do something, put some money into something, and then somebody else comes along and changes it because you don't have the protection.
Yeah, well, and the checkerboard of land ownership that you had to deal with over 1,000 miles, it's not surprising that that's still ongoing.
Yeah.
It's a lot of property owners or agencies or whoever.
Yeah, and sometimes, you might have to wait out till somebody passes on and somebody else inherits their rights and they have a different mentality and are willing to work with you.
Or the other way around.
Yep.
Did it happen the other way around?
Usually not with Congress having designated it. That designation will probably always be there.
But that doesn't mean the property owner has to like it.
No, don't have to like it. And sometimes they may hold out until they pass on, and then somebody else inherits it.
Well, I heard a story about one homestead that the family members that inherited it rerouted the trail around their property. I don't know what year that was, though. Yeah. It might have been before your time.
Yeah, I don't know.
Okay.
I'm not familiar with that one.
Okay.
So.
Mostly you just let the...
I mean, it's possible that that was a resolution.
Well, I don't think it was an agreeable resolution. But I guess that's the question is, yeah, so...
I would think it would depend on, are we talking about cutting across a corner of somebody's property and rerouting around that, and so you have a minor adjustment.
Right.
Or are you talking about...
It sounded like a big reroute.
Several miles of reroute.
Right.
Maybe that was feasible, but if I have good ground going across here and you want me to reroute through a bog, maybe that's not so feasible.
Mm-hmm.
And I know I dealt that with what they call 17B easements, which was access easements across native lands. When they would convey lands to the natives, they would designate easements, rights of way for access to private lands or public lands, so that you didn't get an isolated piece of land somewhere that you didn't have any access to.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes we would reroute that access a little bit to avoid things that were important to the native people.
Mm-hmm.
And I could see that that is possible with this National Historic Trail.
So the National Historic Trail, it's designated a certain route, but you have the ability to do a little rerouting along the way?
Yeah, I mean, because it wasn't surveyed. It was from this town to this town,
mm-hmm.
from this town to this town, this site, And that was the main... And people were using those trails.
Right.
And it was envisioned that they would be, shored up, solidified, done. But in that process, you might need to alter some of that a little bit.
So there's some wiggle room without losing the historic
nature
of it.
Yeah.
Okay.
And that, that would all come into consideration in a decision to alter or reroute that a little bit.
Mm-hmm. In the state, we have these RS-2477 historic routes. How does that relate to the historic trail? Is there any connection there?
There could be some crossover there, I would think. RS-2477 was an authorization to allow states to improve and create roads,
mm-hmm.
basically. And so if they could show that they had contributed use and money to a route to improve that as a road, then they could claim that as an RS-2477 route.
Mm-hmm.
And but the burden on them to show that they had really put money into it and improved it and had used it as a road access as part of that RS-2477, and there are places where roads have crossed over and replaced or planted.
Yeah.
replaced the route,
mm-hmm.
original trail route.
But you don't see that the Iditarod Trail would get would be seen as one of these historic RS-2477 routes, and they try and make a road. susceptible to that? I guess that's the question.
To me, it would be a double layer. I mean, you'd have one on top of the other, basically. Neither one of them would be jeopardized by the other. They'd both exist there. If one ever went away, the other would still remain.
So the historic trail designation doesn't protect the trail from a potential RS-2477 claim if they could prove that they used it?
Yeah, because they would have already have happened. I mean, you're just now recognizing it later.
Okay.
You know, but the fact that it had already been improved and used as a road would already have occurred.
Okay, I get it.
So
thank you for explaining that.
Yeah.
RS-2477 is a very complicated subject, and I only just started thinking about it, that maybe there's a connection.
Well, it's actually was about 1.5 lines in law.
Oh, really? That's all?
That's all.
Is state law or federal law?
Federal law.
Oh, I thought it was a state law.
No, it was a federal law that granted the states the right to improve and create roads, basically, by improving them.
Right.
And if they could show they'd done that, then they could claim that as a road right-of-way under RS-2477 law.
Right. I know there was a big project done to inventory all that stuff. That's a whole nother topic. So you've mentioned a few of the other BLM people, Mike and
Ramona
and Wayne Bowden. Were there other key players or in the other agencies that you remember during your tenure?
Most of that was done at the field management level, and I didn't get involved in that too much. So I don't know names of those other players, but I know they were there and actively involved in it. They met on a regular basis. They, prioritized projects, move, Then I took what the field office pushed forward at the state level for budgeting purposes and,
So do you remember who was in charge of the field office, or is that the name we can't remember?
Yeah, I'll get it for you.
Okay. Because that would have been your main contact through the line, with then Mike as the trail guy.
Yeah.
Was he the trail administrator the whole time you were there, or did it?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, I think so.
Okay.
I wouldn't be certain, but I think so.
I can't remember. the current trail administrator, Kevin Keeler, I can't remember when he started.
So when I went back to the pipeline office, then I didn't really track that too much because I was heavily involved in those pump stations rebuild.
I was thinking during your time where you would have had a purview over the trail.
Yeah.
If there are any other names or players you remember.
No. Fran Cherry was the state director. Sally Wisely was the associate state director through most of that time frame.
Yeah, and it is a little confusing for those of us outside the agency world that there's a state BLM and then there are the local field offices.
Right.
And how a field office interacts with the state level.
So the field offices are on the ground management of the BLM lands and responsibilities. And they report to the state office and to the state director, those field managers. But the state director has his staff that supports him, and that's where the deputy state directors come in. And they're over the various programs statewide to ensure that the field offices are being, that they're all keeping their programs going towards a common purpose and sorting out between the different field offices, priorities and projects, and, you know, and then being the advocates with Washington to support the field offices and the state in accomplishing, you know, the purposes of all of the lands and stuff, you know. Whether it's doing the environmental documentation or permitting different activities on the land and oversighting those activities, or whether it's taking on projects by BLM to interpret, understand the lands better, to protect different resources, things. I mean, you know, I worked with, on the mineral side, I worked with people that studied the land to see if there were even mineral potential at all there.
Right.
Worked with people to determine whether or not mining claims could be patented, whether or not miners were complying with their terms of the permits for their claims, with wildlife, fisheries, those archaeologists, you know, to make sure that all archaeological sites were protected, and that, you know, if streams were impacted, that they were being restored to protect the fisheries and the vegetation on the banks and all of that stuff. You know, we discovered a strain of dusky geese down in the Columbia, or not the Columbia Glacier, which
by Cordova?
Out of Cordova, yeah. Is that the Columbia Glacier?
No, that's out of Valdez.
Can't think of the name.
I know what you're talking about.
Bering Glacier.
Okay.
Out of the Bering Glacier, we discovered a strain of fish up out of Nome, on Lake North of Nome there. I mean, you know, the different, we were involved in all kinds of different things. You know, we dealt with, in our right-of-way, one time Congress said, you know, here's a bunch of money, transfer these lands to the state out of Fairbanks along the river there. And so we had to go up and conduct some hazardous studies to make sure there was no hazardous materials there, that was clear to transfer those lands to the state. And the state wanted to, or the city, I guess, or whoever it was, wanted to preserve that bank as a kind of like a parkland area there. So they wanted to acquire those lands and talk Stevens into giving them money to do that. And so we did all that, transfer the lands to them. You know, just a lot of neat little things that we did.
So you mentioned archaeology, and I was thinking, but on the Iditarod Trail, if archaeological sites or historic sites were something you guys had to deal with.
Yes, you know, you have to deal with all of those resources, renewable resources along there. Anytime you want to do a project on there, you want to make sure you're not going to impact archaeological, if there is any potential there. You want to make sure that's covered. If, you know, if there's any wildlife issues, you know, there are species that are endangered or need to be protected, or if there's opportunities to enhance the public's awareness of wildlife in that area, or to be able to not impact their habitat and resources or food sources, that kind of thing. Or if you're crossing streams or whatever, that the fish, if there's fish in those streams, that they're protected, that you're not just damaging the fish stream. You know, wetlands, if you're crossing wetlands, we dealt with that. Are you creating any kind of a air pollution problems? Is there a lighting or a noise problem you're creating because of the what you're doing? Is it temporary or permanent? You know, those are all kinds of things you have to consider in an environmental analysis.
Were there any archaeological sites along the trail? I mean, there must have been historic places because of the miners.
And I don't have off the top of my head any specific archaeological site, quote unquote, but I think there were some native concerns along there. I know, particularly out in the village of Kinnick, there were graves that were of concern. We went out there with the archaeologist one time, and they showed us where some of those remains were that were in unmarked graves.
So did you guys mark them?
You know, we worked with the community for them to mark, you know, and provide that protection. We wanted to make sure we weren't going to impact those. There was concerns.
Was there ever any consideration, the BLM, to restore some of the old roadhouses?
We would work with the State Historic Preservation Office on which ones of those would were important to protect or restore.
Well, I was saying by the time you were involved, it may have been too late for those buildings.
A lot of the roadhouses were bygones by then, but there were still a few of them around. And I think the state, you know, Historic Preservation Office, and we, you know, Bob King was our archaeologist, state archaeologist. I don't remember who all of the field office ones were. I could look up their names, but
So there was never a project proposed during your time to let's put money into rebuilding a falling down old roadhouse.
Not along the Iditarod Trail that I know of.
It'd be an interesting project.
Yeah. I think there were some along the Richardson Highway.
Yes, there's one in Delta Junction.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I don't remember any along the Iditarod.
Yeah, and I just wonder if anybody ever proposed it, and BLM said, oh no, too much money.
There's always a concern about those. You want to protect those valuable resources, but you don't want to create unnecessary burdens, because, you know, if you've got a dozen roadhouses and you want to protect another one, you know, that becomes a very expensive long-term project to do it right. And so do we really want to spend taxpayers' dollars protecting another roadhouse? Or is it better to spend that money doing something else? You know, and that became an issue when we were looking at the Bureau Mines facilities down in Juneau, is do we want to establish that as sort of a historic property and buildings and facilities or not? Because they did away with the Bureau Mines.
Right.
And there really was nothing left. They didn't save anything.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And
in Juneau, where property is a limited commodity, I could see that those buildings, that acreage, lots, wherever they were, would probably be in demand for something else.
Well, there was a lot of people that wanted that little island. A lot of people wanted that little two-acre island.
Yeah. That factors into the weighing of the decisions.
Yeah.
And the Iditarod Trail is probably a little easier, as there's not much demand for some of those lands. I'm not sure.
It's kind of an interesting thing, because those buildings were old military buildings transferred from Eagle when they had the original mounted troopers out there. And after they took those old buildings down and rebuilt them on that island.
Oh.
And so there were... there was some history behind those buildings as well.
Right. Well, and like in Eagle, they've been restoring all the old Fort Egbert buildings.
Yeah. Well, these are some that were, they had taken down there originally and moved them down there for the Bureau. Originally, it was the Navy had them, had it there as a coal storage site. And then they give it to the Bureau of Mines, and they build, they move those buildings there and establish their offices there.
Well, as I say, Iditarod Trail, you've got the land ownership issues, but there's maybe less competition and demand for those lands and the different uses of those lands.
Well, in the remote areas, for sure. When you get closer into town here, there's just a lot more competition.
Right.
And
if if there's any mining out there, if, you know, like if nowadays they found minerals in Iditarod and wanted to reestablish that, that would have the, would the trail have to be factored into that?
Yes. Yeah, all, that would all be factored in. There, you know, there was, there'd be a lot of environmental issues that would come to play. I mean, you know, we see it in a lot of projects that are proposed nowadays is, you know, the environmental issues are paramount in terms of the decision-making process. And you know, we just live in a culture now that's so much more knowledgeable and sensitive to environmental impacts.
Right. And that and, just having a trail having a historic designation falls lower in the decision making than the environmental impacts?
Well, I mean, I think they go hand in hand. Okay. I mean, I don't, I wouldn't say it's lower. I mean, it's it is a designation, but with that designation, you got to consider all those other things too.
Okay.
And in fact, the consideration of those other environmental concerns is what enhances the historic nature of that trail. So it's, I mean, they go together.
Okay.
So I, you know, I wouldn't say one lower is lower or higher. It's,
okay.
It's part of it. Mm-hmm. It's part of the purpose of it.
Okay. Well, I really appreciate your time today.
Well, I appreciate the opportunity to share a few thoughts.
Yeah. Well, are there any other things you, memories or experiences or things that want I brought up the idea of doing this interview. You want to share?
Oh, I would just thank all of the people that have been involved in this over the years. Thank all of the agencies for their cooperation and communication with this. I as with a lot of our national designations, I mean, these are, this is the heritage of America that we're trying to preserve and enhance and protect, and you know, just grateful for all those people that are willing to chip in and help out with that.
And how do you feel about your role in it?
Awesome. I mean, I look back on my career with BLM and, you know, think that I had a good career. You know, I had a lot of neat opportunities to work on a lot of neat things, and one of those was the Iditarod Trail System. And but, you know, it was one of many other things. And I've always counted it a blessing to be a part of the public lands and working with things that are important to America.
Did you ever get to go out to on the ground on the trail?
Yeah, I've been sewer to mile zero.
Right.
I've been along the Eagle River up to the
Crow Pass.
Crow Pass, yeah. Part of that. I've been on parts of it over in Hope and along in there. I've been out to the Roan Cabin. I've been to Nome, you know, I've been on several parts of it through the years.
Yeah, so you had some opportunity, even though you were the state deputy director, you had some opportunities to go out in the field.
Yeah. And some of that was on my own, mm-hmm. you know, just, you know, being out in the public lands. And part of it was, you know, helping the field people and, you know, learning so that I could be a better representative of Washington for their behalf.
All right. Well, so. Great. Well, thank you very much.
Well, thank you.